And just to give you a word of background on our text this morning, it starts, or at least it contains, I should say, three amazing things some would call mysterious, others impossible, and still others insane. We have a virgin-born child. And if that weren't enough, we have a vision of an angel in a dream. And if that were not enough, we have foreigners who show up because they're, of all things, following a star. Matthew wants you and I to ask, when we read this story, what on earth is going on? Unlike Luke, Matthew is not so focused on, say, the shepherds out in their fields. Matthew focuses on these men from the east. The wise men are some of the most mysterious characters in the New Testament. We'd like to know a lot more about them, but Matthew doesn't really give us as much as perhaps we'd like. Here's what we can say. First, I'm sorry to disappoint you if it's a favorite Christmas carol, but they probably weren't kings. That's actually a later developed tradition. English translations call them wise men, and the word in Greek is magi. These guys were probably priests or court advisors in one of the kingdoms east of Jerusalem. And whoever they were, we can say some things about them with pretty solid certainty. One is that they were not Jewish. I think if they were, it would have told us. It says they're from the east. They were probably pagan astrologers. What's really interesting is that there was one particular place where there was a pretty healthy cult of pagan astrology. Would have had more than a few guys who were interested in star alignments and things like that. The name of that place was Babylon. Babylonian astrologers were students of the stars, and guess what? They were often referred to as magi or wise men. They would also have been priests in a religious cult who specialized in the interpretation of dreams. And that's interesting because as I said a moment ago, Matthew focuses on these guys, Luke focuses on the shepherds, and shepherds, as you've probably heard before, were not exactly high society types. Usually uneducated, out in the field all day, probably smelled really bad. I mean, you remember when Samuel shows up to anoint David as king over Israel, but he doesn't yet know that's who it's going to be. And he says, "Do you have any other children?" Well, there's one. He's little runt out in the fields being a shepherd. And we get excited when we talk about and we read about the announcement to the shepherds, because they were lowly and poor and not looked upon as the sort of people you go to first to announce this sort of thing. But what about these guys, wise men? They certainly had money from the east and probably from Babylon, the place that, if you remember, had defeated Israel about 300 or 400 years ago, taken away men, women, and children, put them into exile, miles and miles away from their promised land. And their entire psalms that are very sad laments about living life in Babylon. I mean, these were Gentiles, which in the eyes of any Jew is bad enough. So it's interesting to note here that in chapter 1, at the end of chapter 1 of Matthew, Matthew talks about the birth of Christ and how he was given a name, Jesus. It means Yahweh saves. It's essentially the same name as Joshua. And then we found out at the end of chapter 1, he's also called Emmanuel. You can see in verse 23 in the italics if you're using one of the Bibles in the pew. Shall call his name Emmanuel. Then you get to verse 25, shall call his name, you're expecting it to be Emmanuel, but it's Jesus. So we have two Hebrew names here, both loaded with meaning and importance, and roots in the Hebrew Scriptures. And so what we would expect to see next are Jewish people coming to worship their Savior. He's got not one, but two Hebrew names. And one of them is a direct fulfillment of a Hebrew prophet. But surprise, surprise, we get pagan astrologers. Filthy foreign Gentiles. That's how they were seen by the Jews, and yet they're the first ones who come searching for the Messiah. It's actually their own study of the stars that leads them to the conclusion a great leader has been born in Judea. That raises all sorts of questions about how God might be working through things like that. But I'm going to table them for a moment, and we'll return to them if there's time. But I just want to point out thus far that God will use any number of means to bring people to Himself. It doesn't necessarily sanctify those means in the sense of the cult of astrology. The Puritans used to say God strikes straight blows with crooked sticks. And I think that's what we see here. And so we come to verse 2 in chapter 2. And they say, "Where is he who has been born king of the Jews? We've seen his star in the east. We've come to worship him." Now, if you would ask people a few weeks before this incident, "Who is the king of the Jews?" what would they have said? Herod. And what they would have meant by that is not, for goodness sake, that Herod was a son of David. Forget being a son of David. Herod wasn't even Jewish by descent. He was an Edomite king who'd been made king by the Romans. He exercised rule over Judea and so was the de facto king of the Jews. But then he hears whispers in the city. The wise men arrive in Jerusalem. They start asking around town, "Where is he who's been born king of the Jews?" And you can imagine what sort of ruckus that must have caused. "We're looking for the king of the Jews. He's been born king of the Jews." You're looking for the what now? And so Herod hears about this, verse 3, and he is troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. It's been said that Herod was a lot more interested in saving his crown than saving his soul. He's troubled because if there is a legitimate son of David somewhere who's going to fulfill these Old Testament or biblical prophecies that he knew well and good, that's a direct threat to his kingship. So he is troubled, and all Jerusalem with him. Because a new king could mean war. So far, this is hardly good news. So he calls in the chief priests and scribes, and what do? Well, they quote Micah 5:2. This passage here in verse 6 in Matthew chapter 2. And look at how it ends. They speak of Bethlehem, Judah, "For out of you shall come a ruler who will shepherd my people Israel." That probably didn't help Herod's situation very much. What's interesting to me is that they have word of this. They have word of these wise men that are searching around, and nobody thought to go with them. I mean, Herod is troubled, and that's a response many have about Jesus. Wherever Jesus goes, he seems to cause trouble. You see, Herod, like most kings and like most people, was a bit of a control freak. He wanted to be in control at every turn, because if he wasn't, then somebody else would steal his power. And Jesus troubles a lot of people because he is a threat to their rule. Jesus is a threat to the way I'm ruling my life, and a threat to the way you're ruling yours, and a threat to the way we're ruling our own little kingdoms. The gospel is not invite Jesus in and he'll make your bad days a little better. It's come and pick up your cross that you might know your king and all that you were made for. He will take from you the one you think you are and transform you into the image of himself. But Herod, like you and me, gets scared when control is threatened. Remember, I said, I think it was 2 weeks ago when I wrapped up the bit on 1 Peter, "Humble yourselves by casting your cares." We get worried because we convince ourselves we know how to run our universe better than God. Biblically speaking, the best thing that can happen to me is that God would take away those little idols. And that's going to trouble me. Unless by God's grace, I surrender them. And so Herod calls them secretly, we see, verse 7. He had secretly caused the wise men, determined from them what time the star had appeared. And then in verse 8, he sends them to Bethlehem. "Go and search carefully for the young child. When you found him, bring back word to me that I may worship him also." Now we know from the rest of the story, Herod's lying. The gospel presents to us Jesus, a king who lays down his life. Herod is not that kind of king. He has no interest in being that kind of king. He'll hold on to his power at any cost. But his words must have rung true, at least for these out-of-town wise men. Oh, we've traveled to find the new king. We're pretty sure we're going to find him. The old king is going to help us out. He's seeking the same thing we are. Awesome. Everybody's on the same page. Not so much. But we do read that the star went before them until it rested over the place where the child was. Let's read that. They heard the king and departed, and behold, the star which they had seen in the east went before them till it came and stood over where the young child was. And Matthew's use of the word behold here, it literally means look. It's like when you're telling a story and you're so excited about it, you preface it with tiny bits to hold attention. You say, well, I was walking, I bumped into a friend, and then this happened. And then, I mean, you're kind of holding it all together by these little, it's called a Leitwort in German, a leading word that sort of cues you to make sure you listen in, that what is about to happen is super important. And so what happens after he says, behold? Well, they find their king. They find the one they're looking for. When they saw the star, they rejoiced with exceedingly great joy. Can you hear the overkill? It's very intentional. If the text was about sadness and mourning, you can imagine it'd be, they wept exceedingly with crying great sadness. He's not just making a point here. He's using every way he can. He's exhausting the language to tell you that these guys, when they found what they were searching for, rejoiced with a joy that could hardly be described. And so rather than attempt to describe it, he throws a little word party and basically says they were so overjoyed that they joyed exceedingly with joyful joy. They were deliriously happy. And then what happens in verse 11? When they came to the house, they saw the young child with Mary, his mother. They fell down and worshipped him. And when they'd opened their treasures, an important word, because a few chapters later in this gospel, Jesus is going to talk about the treasure in heaven and the treasure on earth. They opened their treasures, they presented gifts to him, gold, frankincense, and myrrh. They fell down and worshipped him and gave their treasures. And it's interesting to note that the verb here, to offer, it's the same verb that's used to speak of people offering sacrifices. And I think that's going to help us understand what exactly is going on here with these gifts. We read that they were gold, frankincense, and myrrh. And what does that mean? The most popular interpretation I have heard of what exactly these gifts mean is mainly allegorical, right? So gold, for instance, symbolizes the royalty and the recognition that Jesus is king of the Jews. The frankincense symbolizes deity because frankincense was a kind of oil that was used, you could make it for perfume, for medicinal purposes, but also in a lot of religious rituals. And then myrrh symbolizes the suffering and death. It was very similar to frankincense in that it was used in perfumes, but it was very expensive, very potent, and later we read that myrrh was used for preparing a body for burial. Okay, so that's a sort of allegorical, symbolic interpretation. Typically, I mean, I've heard it very frequently given today, and that's fine. The only problem I have with it is, there's not really anything compelling me in the text to come to that interpretation. But it certainly is fun and interesting. I mean, allegory always is fun for those reasons. But after the mention of frankincense and myrrh here in the Gospels, those two things don't show up for the rest of the New Testament. Aside from mentioning things for burial. They don't show up in some of the other Gospels. Really, the only time we find them paired together again is in Revelation 18. We read about rich merchants who are carrying silver, silk, and pearls among a list of precious items that includes frankincense and myrrh. So what does all that mean? Well, my answer begins with this question, why would you own that stuff in the first place? Why would you own gold? Well, helps you to buy things. Why would you own perfumes like frankincense or myrrh? Well, they certainly set you apart from the rest of society, like, say, the shepherds, for instance. They make you smell nice. And in a world without showers, perfume's a really solid thing to have. They're not attempting to fill a need. Because you don't fill God's needs, right? You don't fill a king's needs. Can you imagine if someone showed up in the court of a king with some money? I just thought you could use the extra cash, Your Majesty. That'd be an insult. So what's going on here? This is an extension of their joy, the joy that we just read about in verse 10. John Piper gives a really helpful illustration here. He talks about, I think I've used it before, but pardon me, I'll use it again. He speaks of a husband buying flowers for his wife. He says, if a husband comes home and gives flowers to his wife, and she says, well, these are beautiful. And he says, well, just doing my duty. You know, that's my job. I don't think she's going to feel treasured. But if she says, these are beautiful, and he says, it's my joy to give them to you. They make you happy. It's my joy to make you happy. I love buying this for you. It reminds everyone that the money in my wallet is nothing compared to you being reminded that you're loved. That is what is going on here, I think. That's what these wise men are doing. Why does God give us money in the first place? God gives us money so we can show the world that money's not our treasure. Right? Why did these wise men give gifts to Jesus? It was a demonstration that their joy in Him, that we read about in verse 10, was greater than what gold could buy for them. Greater than the status that these oils and perfumes might give to them. And so what I want you to notice here from this text, first of all, be careful about falling into the trap of thinking that until you do the right sort of things, you have the right sort of patterns in your life, or even the right set of feelings, that you can't really become or be a Christian. There's only one thing that is required to become a Christian, and that is the knowledge that you are more sinful than you want to be. Notice the wise men didn't even know his name, and they were seeking him. They didn't even learn his name yet. That's why through the text, Matthew keeps calling him the young child. Right? It's like we're traveling with the wise men. You already have a lot more knowledge about Jesus than the wise men did. And we forever remember them because all they did was offer up what they had and they worshipped. They worshipped. And second, I think the giving of the gift shows us something in terms of how do you kill the things that kill your soul. You surrender them. The wise men surrendered their gold, their frankincense, their myrrh, the things that gave them their measure of safety and security in the world. They set them apart and gave them up. What enabled them to do that? Verse 10, rejoiced exceedingly with great joy. We sin because we believe in the moment of temptation that sin's what's going to make us happy. Right? The only thing that can kill that in my heart and in yours is a greater, bigger happiness. A joy that rejoices with exceedingly great joy. The gospel invites us to come and find in Jesus a joy that is bigger than the passing pleasure of our sin. And so, I know that we all come to church this morning with different distractions and different things that are weighing on our heart. Perhaps it is a struggle with control, that your life only has meaning when you have power over others. The reality is you won't have peace with that until you come face to face with the one who has the power to save you. Until you see the King who was made low, that you might be rescued. Well, maybe life would be great if I just had a little more money. That's going to plague you until you come face to face with the king who's worth more to his people than all the gold in the world. Whatever this morning you come hoping for or you're afraid of or you're frustrated by, the hopes and fears of all the years are answered by him. All of it's answered in Emmanuel, our God and King who's come to us. And this is why during this season we sing, O come, let us adore him. The gospel's come and see, but it's also go and tell. Right before this text with the wise men, we're given this Emmanuel name, right? Behold, the virgin shall be with child and will bear a son. They shall call his name Emmanuel, which is translated God with us. And after being told God is with us, we see the Gentiles coming to worship, the King of the Jews. That's how the story begins, but how does it end? The Great Commission. Go, therefore, into all the nations. That's where we're going. All the nations, the whole world, the wise, the rich, the foolish, the poor, across every ethnic and racial and economic boundary. Why? Because Emmanuel. Because Jesus tells us, behold, I am with you until the end of the age. Our story begins the same way it ends, with the promise of Emmanuel, God with us, and that salvation of the most unlikely sort is the gospel, that those who are seeking God will always find him. Those who find him will rejoice exceedingly with great joy because they've discovered a treasure worth more they could ever want. So realize that God doesn't just happen to choose unlikely candidates here. That's what God does at the fundamental level. Chief priests, scribes, and King Herod should have been the most likely to believe. But they remained in Jerusalem while a bunch of pagan astrologers came face to face with the Son of God. And so part of my goal this morning is to try and convince you that if your struggle is that because of a particular sin or past or sinful habit, that even just believing God loves you is difficult. Just know that you are never beyond the love of God because there's more grace in him than sin in you. You can't out-sin his grace. This is very good news. And he calls us this morning to imitate wise men, to surrender whatever's keeping us from him and worship. Because we're never beyond his reach. And so, if you are hurting at this time of year, as I said earlier this morning, Advent is not a time of contrived joy, of fabricated happiness. It is a time of longing, of feeling this sense of the seeming, emphasis on seeming, the seeming absence of God. A time where we are waiting for the second Advent, where all things will be set right. And a time where, in the meanwhile, we joyfully surrender and worship. We find our joy in Emmanuel, God with us. And that is in part why this morning is a communion Sunday. Emmanuel, God with us, is what this table is all about. It's a time when we're reminded that God is with us and that we participate in that reality as we feed on Christ by the power of His Holy Spirit, His presence among us this morning. And so if you want to see the compassion and the mercy of our God, it's here at this table.